It happened on December 15th, 1956. Several individual performers and groups had gathered for a musical extravaganza at the state fairgrounds in Shreveport, Louisiana. One act in particular had caught the crowd's fancy. After singing for 45 minutes, the performer took his bows and exited the stage. The crowd, however, became so loud and animated in demanding an encore that the next group had trouble setting up and getting started. Some members of the crowd, most of them hormone-crazed young women, even tried to go outside and plead with the musician to return. That is when Horace Lee Logan, the concert organizer, stepped to the stage and took up the microphone, pleading with the crowd to take their places and let the other acts perform. He famously proclaimed, "Please, young people, return to your seats." And you can say it with me if you know it. "Elvis has left the building." I thought of that famous catchphrase as I was preparing for this morning's message. I thought of a variation of that phrase. And it seems rather appropriate. As you heard Judy say earlier, yesterday several hundred volunteers gathered in the parking lot of my home church, First United Methodist, for a day of service to the community. Pam, Stan, me, and I count them 13 other members of our church were there to pitch in. And by the way, we had more people from our church than any other church had there. So, yeah. After some initial instructions and a short prayer, we boarded school buses and headed out to various helping agencies located around town. My particular group headed to Spring Lake Park for a day of cleaning. You can't believe what pigs some people are. You can't believe how many tires we pulled out of the various ravines around the park. But it was exciting to see so many people ready and willing to share the love of Christ through a day of service to our community. Yesterday's event was part of Celebrate Community Day, an opportunity for churched and non-church people alike to rethink what church is all about. The good folks at United Methodist Communications put it this way: what if church was less about Sunday, more about the other days of the week? What if church just wasn't a place to go, but something to do? What if church just wasn't a building, but thousands of doors, each opening up to a different concept or experience of church? You may have read the article in the World Herald this week in which Stephanie Alshwey, by the way, it's a great article, terrible picture of Stephanie, but a great, great article. Stephanie is the director of United Methodist Ministries here in Omaha. And she said that Saturday's event was a time for people inside the church to consider what the church is and what it can be, and for people outside the church to do the same. Or to borrow the phrase from the late Horace Lee Logan, yesterday was a time for us, members of the church, to say to the rest of the world, the church has left the building. I believe that's a very important message that needs to be shared, not just on days like yesterday, but on every day. And why? Well, before I answer that question, a little review might be helpful. As you heard when I read our scripture from the book of Acts just a moment ago, the early Christians worshiped in individuals' homes. In those homes, they would break bread together, serve one another, and practice a unity and a love with each other unlike anyone had ever experienced before. House churches were the norm for several generations. As the faith spread and more people became Christian, however, house churches, well, they were just no longer feasible. So sometime around the mid-third century, buildings specifically designed for Christian worship began to appear. Archaeology tells us that the first known Christian church was probably built around the year 230 in the ancient Syrian city of Dura Europos. It was actually nothing more than someone's house that had a large meeting room attached to it. After the Emperor Constantine converted in 312 and Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, Constantine erected what may have been the first standalone church building, the original St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. His mother, Helena, is considered to be the first great church builder. She traveled to the Holy Land and she became the patron of many church buildings. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre was among her most famous projects. After the capital of the Roman Empire was moved from Rome to Constantinople, the beautiful St. Sophia or Hagia Sophia was built by the Emperor Justinian between 532 and 537. But archaeologists tell us that there were churches, many different churches on that particular site prior to that time. Almost everyone agrees that the move from home churches or house churches to specific church buildings was the result of a very natural and gradual progression that involved the growth of the faith and the end of its persecution. But as a pastor who used to have a Sunday school class meeting in his house every Sunday, my parsonage was right next to the church, even closer than the old one was across the street over there, I would like to offer an alternative understanding of how church buildings came about. I am convinced that the movement from house churches to church buildings happened something like this. One day, some pastor's wife somewhere said, "I am sick and tired of having to clean the house every Saturday night so that you can have worship in the living room on Sunday morning. Either you find another place to meet, or I'm calling my mother and having her come and live with us so I can have some help." And the rest, as they say, is history. I'll bet you anything that's exactly how it happened. Now, as we know, there are some beautiful, beautiful churches in the world. The cathedral at Chartres, the National Cathedral in Washington, and even St. Cecilia's here in Omaha are places of amazing beauty. Church architecture has been the one place where all of the world's great arts can come together in a single place, and it has become one of the defining marks of Western civilization. Sociologically speaking, churches have also become gathering places for their communities as well. How many of you, and raise your hands, how many of you have ever been to a piano recital at the church? Or not at this church, but at any church, okay? How many of you have ever been or ever voted within a church? How many have your precinct meeting in a church? How many of you, and Don, you need to count so you could tell the bishop, how many of you have ever been to a Friday night Lenten fish fry in a church? Raise your hand. See, that's good. That's good data for you to take down to conference. In so many ways, churches provide so many vital functions. Unfortunately, the building of these very needed and very necessary places for Christians to worship and communities to gather has become so common, as you have heard, the word church now refers to the building as much as it does to the body of believers that meet inside. These days, for example, we talk about going to church. We use references such as the church on the corner when giving directions to our friends. We play volleyball and basketball at the church. It has become common to call the building in which Christians gather for a variety of different activities the church. And I understand why that is so. But as Richard Avery and Don Marsh have reminded us, the church is not a building. The church is not a steeple. The church is not a resting place. The church is a people. Or in other words, and if you know the chorus, you can say it with me. I am the church. You are the church. We are the church together. Now that's not a big surprise, right? After all, the word for church in the New Testament is ecclesia, which literally means called out people or assembly of people. The church or the ecclesia consists of the people that God has called out. Those men and women that God has assembled to share the good news of Jesus Christ with the rest of the world. You probably won't be surprised to hear that ecclesia has nothing to do with buildings. The scriptures are filled with passages that bear out this definition. When Paul wrote to Philemon, for example, he sent his letter to the church that meets in your house. Last time I looked, it was sort of hard for a building to meet in a house. When the book of Acts reported that King Herod killed James and imprisoned Peter, the church gathered and began to pray. Once again, it's sort of hard for buildings to gather and start to pray. When John sent letters to the seven churches of Asia Minor, he was very well aware that it wasn't the building that would be reading them. It would be the people. And when the Ephesians read of their calling, they heard that it would be through the church that the wisdom of God would be heard. Although any architect worth his salt will tell you that buildings make a statement, even the most arrogant among them is reluctant to say that the wisdom of God can be heard through the language of bricks and mortar. Even they know that the wisdom of God comes through the words and actions of the people who are already experiencing the wisdom of God. The church consists of people. We all know that to be the case, but it doesn't hurt to be reminded of that fact every once in a while. And that is why days like yesterday are so important for you and for me. But that reminder is not just important for those of us who are already inside the church. It is important for those outside the church as well. In a book entitled, They Like Jesus But Not the Church, They Like Jesus But Not the Church, Dan Kimball reports on hundreds of interviews he conducted around the country with 20-something young people. As the title of the book implies, he found that these young people are just as spiritual as those of older generations. They have a deep respect and an outstanding admiration of Jesus, and they have no problem with giving their lives to them. Their problem comes with the church. Their list of issues they have with it is far too long to be detailed this morning. So let me focus upon just one. When Kimball asked these young people what they wish the church were like, one of their biggest concerns went like this. We wish the church weren't about the building. We wish the church weren't about the building. Those he interviewed have the impressions that far too many Christians see the building as the church, that their focus of faith is too often limited to what happens within its walls. Their biggest desire is that the church moves beyond those walls. A woman named Alicia remarked, "I wish the church were not always about being in a church building. It seems that the church wants us always to come to them, but they don't want to come to us. Didn't Jesus meet with all kinds of people in all kinds of places?" In interview after interview, Kimball found that young people would like to see less focus upon the building and be a part of a church that has left the building. If you remember the story of Methodism, then you realize that this is really nothing new. And if you do remember the story, then you will know that the spark that started the Methodist revival happened that moment when John Wesley finally accepted the invitation of his friend and traveled to Bristol, where he preached to coal miners out in a field. The proper Anglican that he was, he had never done anything that vile, that's how he put it, he had never done anything that vile before. As a matter of fact, he once wrote in his journal that prior to that day, he thought it practically a sin to save souls in any other place outside of the four walls of a church building. But when he saw the tears running down the sooty faces of those coal miners and felt the Holy Spirit moving among them, he knew that something remarkable was happening. It was that moment that helped Wesley later to say, "The world is my parish." Horace Lee Logan might say that Methodism was born the day that the church left the building. And if he did say that, he would be very, very correct. Several years ago, 10 United Methodist congregations came together to build a Habitat for Humanity house in a week. In a week. Extreme Makeover Home Edition had nothing on us. It was fun to see 100 different people from several different Mississippi congregations come together to make something like this happen. It was an amazing week. We had that house dried in by the end of the first day. It was remarkable. Now, even though we started each day with a prayer, nothing particularly religious happened that time. Oh, I suppose those who drove by saw the cross and the flame on the sign in front of the house. But other than that opening prayer, nothing else took place. Well, at the end of that week, when everything was finally done, we invited our bishop to come out and lead us in the dedication. Even though it was 100 degrees with 95% humidity that day, we were all outside wearing our Sunday best. After his remarks, in which the bishop said some very nice things, he asked if there was anything who had anything they wanted to say. One of the little Burton girls raised her hand. Stanley Burton and his wife, the couple for whom we had built the house, had two beautiful 6-year-old twin daughters named Cagney and Lacey. Now, please know that those who participated in that build have thought of every wisecrack that is running through your mind right now, So you can't tell me anything that I haven't already heard. But it was Lacey who had raised her hand and volunteered to speak. I can still remember she wore this purple dress with white anklets and patent leather shoes, and she had about, 8 or 10 braids in her hair sticking out all different ways, and little purple matching bows on the end of each braid. And she was missing her two front teeth. All eyes were on her as she walked up and stood next to the bishop. She said, "I'd like to thank Jesus for my new house." It was one of the few times that I ever saw that particular bishop speechless. It really wasn't a surprise, however, as the rest of us were at loss for words as well. As I said, other than offering a prayer at the beginning of each day, and Cagney and Lacey were with us every day, other than offering their prayer, that prayer, there was nothing particularly religious happening. I didn't preach. I didn't take up an offering. But even though she was only 6 years old, Lacey understood what had happened. The church had left the building. And because it did, nothing in that little girl's life would ever again be the same. I ran across a quote the other day, and it goes like this. "We are called to be fishers of men and women, not keepers of the aquarium." We are called to be fishers of men and women, not keepers of the aquarium. Now, that may sound a little trite, but it makes a very, very important point that we need to remember. We all know that aquariums are beautiful. They provide a warm and safe environment for its inhabitants. And it provides us with something very soothing and calming to look at after a very frustrating day. An aquarium keeper, however, is only concerned about the preservation of the aquarium. He or she is mainly interested about only those things that are inside. Now, there's no doubt that aquarium keeping is an important and vital task. So is church keeping. You and I are called to take care of each other and to preserve the fellowship that we share, and we are called to preserve the building in which we do that. But our call is not limited to preservation alone. We are called to expansion as well. We are called to mission as well. We are not only called for those to care for those on the inside, but to care for those on the outside as well. And the only way for us to do that is to walk out the doors of this building and into the community that surrounds us. The world around us is waiting for that time that they can truly say the church has left the building. And I would imagine that God is waiting for that day too. Let's bow our heads and pray. God, you have called us to be the church. And you have called the church to leave the building. Help us to do so. Amen.